Hey, Jeff here.
Craig here.
We're just going to take a little moment before we kick into today's festivities. And we're going to tell you a bit about our friends over at Glee Coffee.
Oh,
yeah. They're an Australian-owned roaster, coffee roaster, that is.
Central Coast?
And they have, from the Central Coast, that's your darn tootin', Craig. And they have an absolute cracker of a blend of coffee. This is my favourite from the Glee team. It's called the Verve, Craig.
Oh, yeah. And it's not bittersweet. It's not a bittersweet symphony.
Not at all. And let's be honest, we don't want that in a coffee at all.
Damn,
and you won't
right.
get it with the Verve.
You'll get a beautiful hit of coffee, hit of caffeine, as well as obviously not being too much where it overtakes the palate.
I love it. This is literally, it's this rich, caramelly, chocolatey taste. Oh, dang. It's been likened to a jam session for your taste buds, Craig.
A jam session. I love it. A good jam session.
That's right. It's like in all the right ways.
All the right ways.
So, Craig, where can people get their hands on some?
Guys, go onto the website gleecoffee.com.au/store. Get on there, buy some hoodies. Make sure you get the Verve. It's absolutely beautiful. Go out there. They've got plenty out there on the range out there. Make sure you put it in. And if you're a bit worried between the 500 gram and 1 kilo, I tell you what, go down to the discount code and type in FFTL. It's a secret code just for our fans, and you'll get 15%
off. 15%
off.
Buy cheaper more. Coffee. Buy free more. Shipping Australia-wide.
Oh, yeah. That's heaps good, man. That's heaps good.
And if you're listening to us from overseas, you want to get your hands on some of this, knock on the door. Our friends at Glee, they want to send you some.
They want to hear it.
That's
right.
They just
want to make sure that everyone's out there ready to buy it. Get on there.
That's exactly right.
Remember, Australia has amazing coffee. Look it up. Don't believe us? Look it up.
They are, Glee Coffee are award-winning roasters. They once won a thing called the Golden Bean, Craig.
Oh, damn.
That's right. It's like the Oscars for coffee. So check them out. We love them. We can't wait for you to get your hands on some. So let's get into today's episode, Craig.
Let's get there.
Hey, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And this is From First to Last Podcast. First to Last Podcast. It's a podcast where my friend Craig and I, we get together each week. We work our way through a director's theatrical filmography from their first film all the way through to their last. And Craig, we are actually at the second last film for Michael Mann's filmography. Can you believe it?
Crazy.
I know.
It's been crazy quick, yet not quick. Like, it's crazy quick, but so damn eventful, man.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said that because compared to, I find that a lot of the times with our seasons, I'm sort of already onto the next, mentally I'm onto the next director sort of by this stage of the season.
Yep.
And I'm sort of a little bit there, but I'm actually loving Michael Mann's work because I'm still excited for the next film.
Yeah. Same. I'm just pumped to just see where it's going now.
Yes.
This is, I would say, the lesser known part of his career for me because I never really, like, I probably watched him, but I never really paid much attention to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so fascinating, isn't it? And I love that even when we get sort of, I'm calling it I don't want to call it a miss, but if we get something like last week's film, which was Miami Vice.
Yeah. That
wasn't sort of the booming success of Michael Mann's films.
Nope.
But what he's doing, and I'm finding I love it, is when he has something that's not as successful as, say, previous work that he's done, he basically goes and flips what he does the previously on its head. So if we think about, say, like The Keep, that was not a critical success, not a box office success, also not a great creative experience, he flips that and goes from this really dark gothic film to a sweeping epic romance set with Native Americans. And
yeah.
I think it's quite fascinating today because we're sort of doing that again, which Miami Vice was such a dark and grainy and gritty film. It almost has this, like, I don't know, it was sort of down, you know, like it's sort of deep and dark. Oh, and
it is dark. It's not a fun film.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what you really wanted a bit of. Like, I don't expect all of it to be fun, you know. I don't expect every film to be a Marvel movie. But, yeah. You know, I expected just a little bit of banter.
Yes, totally, Craig. And we didn't quite get that. But I love what he does now and flips it. Because the moment you start Public Enemies, and I'm just going to get into the film straight away, Craig. I hope that's okay.
Oh, crack light.
But, like, the moment you start in Public Enemies, we've got this bright, outdoor film, you know, like it's all daytime. And I don't know whether that's a conscious decision of I'm overdoing night shoots for Michael Mann, but like it's so bright and peaceful and everything just feels so, I know it's of the era, but it also feels so rural.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, definitely.
And I just love, it was like, for me, it was a real surprise straight from the get-go to go, oh, wow, he really shoots daytime beautifully.
Yeah, exactly. It does, doesn't he? To quote an Australian poet, it's always sun bleached. You know what I mean? And it's basically, it's always, every time you go, he chooses the right colors as well that just make everything pop on the screen. I love it. I love it.
Totally. Also, this is, and I wasn't going to go there till later, but we'll do it now. This is, he's been testing the waters with digital filmmaking.
Definitely.
So we had a little taste in Ali. We got a lot of digital throughout Collateral and Miami Vice. And now we've reached the point, this is his first full HD digital film. And it's gorgeous to look at, Craig.
It is in some bits. I have to admit, there are some parts where I'm just like, It's so digitally clear that it's distracting, that it actually breaks the tone.
Interesting. Are you talking about sort of the cinema scenes towards the end?
Like no, I'm talking more about the shootout in the woods.
Yep.
So it's a little bit...
But again, that's when night's involved, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a little bit too clear for me. Like during the day, like everything during the day, you can't argue it. It's fucking beautiful. And it's and above all that, it's cool. Like everything's cool. Like there's not one uncool person in that whole world. Yeah. But there's the shootout scene where obviously they all come in and they supposedly trap him as well as Babyface Nelson and Dillinger, and there's a shootout in the woods. I think it's too clear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And because it being too clear, where if you think of other films where it's a little bit darker and it's just the spray of the only light really is the spray of the guns, there's a little bit more tension to it. There's a little bit more claustrophobia to it, like running through the woods and everything like that. You know that when they're running through the woods, they can barely see. In this one, it looks like... It looks like those, you know, there's those dodgy video film clips where they try to make it feel like nighttime, but you can tell it's actually filmed today. Like Catherine Bigelow's surfing moment in Point Break, you know, the night surf, you know, like that. And you can feel a bit of that. And it takes away from the tension of the film a bit, especially in those sequences where that sequence is meant to be so claustrophobic when they're running from each other.
Yeah, I can see it. I probably don't feel as strongly about it as you do, Craig, but that's
definitely
all good.
Dude, that's the strongest thing I've felt in ages. Strongest thing I've had since an erection. But I don't feel that strong. It pulled me away from it, that's all.
Yeah.
Because it's such everything builds up in that sequence, especially with Babyface Nelson, because the tension builds up and you're going, man, this is going to explode, you know, and Christian Bale's outside, Purvis is outside, he's ready to kick ass. And then, and that just kicked me out, that's all. So, that's me bitching.
I can see, and that's probably, you're highlighting a general complaint when it came to the digital medium when it was first being used. You know, film versus digital, people talked about the way that it pulled you out of the experience by how sharp and almost grainy it was in some some facets. So let's just kick in then, Craig, because there's heaps to talk about in this film, and I love it. And we do have a little bit of a journey for the film itself. So we've actually had 3 years between the release of Miami Vice and the release of Public Enemies. Now, as we know, Michael Mann's not one to take long holidays between projects. And despite his output being a little less of a journeyman, he's and more of a meticulous preparation sort of filmmaker, he's still really active in those moments between projects. So over the last decade, Mann has been involved in the development of a few projects that have all been released between Miami Vice and Public Enemies. He may not necessarily have been, say, a writer or a credited director, but he's been very active in the project still. Sort of like we found out with the Miami Vice TV show. He was only on as a producer, but he was still very hands-on with assisting in the filming, the aesthetics, all that
stuff. He's a control freak, let's be honest. There's nothing that fucking dude wouldn't do that he wouldn't have to take control of.
Yeah, I think so. And it's because, again, I think he's so clear in his vision of what he thinks is going to be great for the film.
He'd be the worst guy in an orgy. He'd be fucking horrible. Nah, that leg needs to go there. That's the wrong hole to start off with. That should be one towards the end of the night.
Oh, great.
So but you can just imagine him. He just like, I have a vision on how this orgy should be.
Yeah.
And this is where we're going to lay it out. This is how we're going to lay it out.
Nope. Not you, Frank. Get out of here.
Nope. Sorry, Johnny. Nope.
So, Craig, Mann's actually got two films that are released during this period where he was listed as a producer. Yep. Now, the first is a really fascinating one, which was a long-developed project called Tonight He Comes. The film was now, I don't know if you remember this film being in production, Craig.
Yeah, I do. We were so pumped, hey?
Yeah, we were so stoked about this project. And the film, it's basically a dark take around a person who has superpowers. He uses them for all the wrong reasons. Not as a villain, but just he's just abusing those powers.
He's just a broken dude with like mental health issues, and he also has, you know, but he also has superpowers.
Yes. Totally. And so the project then goes on to morph and evolve into a Will Smith film that was released, directed by Peter Berg, if I remember rightly.
Peter Berg, yep.
And that's called Hancock. Now, Mann stays on as a producer for this film, but he was actually signed on as a director when it was listed as Tonight He Comes.
Wow, that would have been weird, hey? Yeah, because it was so much darker. It was so dark, the original screenplay. I remember us hearing about the...
Insanely dark. It was a dark comedy and saw, you know, the main character watching porn at times, jerking off. He killed cops. He even at one stage in the film tries to sexually assault a woman. It's like really dark. It's probably, in more future terms, it's probably close to what we get in, say, The Boys.
Yeah, definitely.
And so probably... Mann's take in this dark sort of take is a very trailblazing thing for what we get now. But at that time, no one was doing that sort of thing with a superhero, quote unquote.
Yeah, exactly.
So
comic books were. They were around the Boys was around at that time.
Yeah.
Also, Tony Stark, Demon in a Bottle, that whole Iron Man thing. Where he was an actual alcoholic. Yeah, it's pretty crazy, some parts of those. But yeah, in the movie industry, nah, everyone was Superman clean.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
In essence, you know. Even Batman was Batman clean, wasn't he?
Yeah, totally. And so with the lead character, throughout all this hard times and abuse of power, he actually longs to be the sort of hero that he believes that his gifts deserve. And the film is all about him grasping that and becoming the hero in the end. Totally different to the film we actually get with Hancock. In essence, the themes are still there. But
yeah, I thought Will Smith originally, from memory, he signed on when it was still a gritty film.
Yes, totally.
And then he Will Smithed it.
Yeah.
I guess like he would have done with Django.
Yes.
And so basically there was a struggle in that, you know what I mean? Like, it's nowhere near as, obviously, it's a fully Will Smithy film.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And interesting little thing, in my research, Craig, I actually had Will Smith, a lot of that information was offered by Will Smith in a interview that he was doing for Hancock. And during the press conference for Hancock, he also said around the same time he was offered the role of Superman.
Yeah.
For Bryan Singer's Superman Returns. And he said he declined. And in the press conference, I love this quote, so I just had to share it. He said, "I declined it. You mess with white people's heroes in Hollywood and you'll never work in this town again."
That's very true. Love very it. True. Everyone's cracking shits now over in the States because Superman's son has come out as bi.
Yeah, I saw that this week. Books. Interesting.
It's Superman's son. But every all of them would come out and go, Superman is now bi. No, it's Superman's son.
Yes. And all the headlines said Superman was.
But yeah, exactly. No. Son of Kal-El, the series is.
So funny. Now, Mann also served as a producer for Peter Berg's The Kingdom. The film starred Jamie Foxx and was an idea Berg had around the time of filming Collateral. So Berg was a part of the casting Collateral, and Mann was pretty hands-on in The Kingdom. He assisted with the filming of crucial action scenes, such as the shootouts, and even did press promotion for the film.
So, funny thing is, Berg was a dark director, man.
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen Pretty Little Things?
Yeah.
Very Bad Things.
Very Bad Things. Man. That is a dark fucking film.
So dark.
And I remember watching that. Jon Favreau in that?
John Favreau, Cameron Diaz, Christian Slater. They end up killing the best man and then they chop his body up. Isn't that what they do?
No, they kill the stripper.
That's right.
So they bring a stripper in and obviously they end up, one of them ends up sleeping with her. And by accident,
I think it's Favreau.
They're bouncing around, you know, the whole sex against the wall thing. Does sex against the wall and she kills herself on a hook.
Yeah, the towel hook.
On a towel hook.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it gets hardcore after that.
Yeah, but
like
totally.
After watching that very, very dark comedy, that's why you and I were like, oh man, Tonight He Comes. Peter Berg is awesome at this shit.
Yeah,
but
we
then
were so
seriously,
stoked.
Ever since that film, I've struggled to be impressed with Peter Berg.
It's interesting because The Kingdom is a film that shows he's got a lot of directing talent. And so I think like you could watch that film and you can see Mann's fingerprints throughout the film.
Are the fight sequences very, you know?
Yeah, I remember watching it and just being like, I didn't know the connection between Berg and Mann. So at the time watching it, it felt Hurt Locker-ish. And it was sort of same color palette. It really was. It's a decent film. I need to revisit it though, Craig, because I'd hate to revisit it and just find out that it's not Grant. Now, the other project that Mann was working on at this time was a film based around a book called Go Like Hell. Now, the project itself had been in development for quite a few years, and Mann stepped away from it to focus on making Miami Vice, but he stays on as the film's producer and oversees production throughout this time. Now, that film moves from Mann no longer directing to Joseph Kaczynski directing.
I love Joseph Kaczynski.
And the film ended up having both Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt attached to be the leads for the film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, what's really sad, Craig, is unfortunately it's over a decade before we actually get to see Go Like Hell in cinemas. And it was released under a new name, starring both Matt Damon and Christian Bale, directed by James Mangold, and that film was Ford versus Ferrari.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. So Mann's actually listed as a producer on Ford versus Ferrari. And so he's overseeing production of that and development of that, as well as what becomes Hancock involved with that. So that's pretty much what Mann's been up to between Miami Vice and Public Enemies.
I just did a quick check. I just wanted to check what Peter Berg has done since.
Yeah.
And almost every film he's done since.
Yep.
Like, obviously, he did Battleship.
Hey, Craig. Underrated little fun popcorn film.
Don't say Jeff. Oh, Jeff.
Battleship,
you had to say it.
Is a fun little underrated
Jeff, you
film.
Had to say it. Jesus. He's done a couple of Maroon 5 clips.
What?
But mainly, man, he works with Mark Wahlberg. Pretty much every Mark Wahlberg film afterwards, Lone Survivor.
Yeah.
He did some Leftovers, Deepwater Horizon, Patriots Day, Mile 22,
what?
And then Spencer Confidential.
What?
These are all his movies, man. This is all his movies, like The People's Fighter. He did that. I don't know who's in that. But I think that's a documentary. He did a couple of episodes of Ballers, a couple of episodes of Leftovers and Breakthrough. But yeah, everything else is friggin' Mark Wahlberg.
Wow. He might have shares in Wahlburgers.
Oh, friggin' oath, man. Jeez, damn.
So, Craig, that's pretty much what Michael Mann's been up to. Good old Peter Berg. He deserves a few revisits of his films. Maybe we
no, he doesn't. I'm not watching Spencer Confidential, man. fucking all these Patriot Day, all these, you know. Like, Patriot Day literally has a flag paste. Well, it is Patriots Day, but a flag pasted over it. I can't watch that shit no more. That's
love
my
it.
Head.
So this is what Michael Mann's been up to between films. And amongst all of that, he's sort of developing Public Enemies, which we've actually talked about his work on this project earlier in the season. So it's an idea that Mann's already dabbled in. But before we really dig super deep into this, let's just take a moment, Craig. And for those at home who may know nothing about the film, who may have watched it a while ago, or just flat out loved this film, let's just take a moment and let's just hear about it.
An FBI special task force tries to hunt down notorious gangster John Dillinger during a booming crime wave set in the 1930s Depression era. Starring Johnny Depp, Christian Bale and Marion Cotillard, let's chat about Michael Mann's last gangster epic, Public Enemies.
So good, Craig. Now, Public Enemies was released July 1st, 2009. And took around $214 million at the worldwide box office.
That's pretty damn good, man.
Yeah, it is. It's rumored the budget was $80 to $100 million. Ooh. I like how Michael Mann, as his season's gone on, has a sliding scale of budget. It's not a specific figure. It sort of slides away. But as I mentioned before, like, I think you really see a lot of it on the screen in this film.
Oh,
it's
incredibly.
Beautiful film.
The set design and everything on this must have been hard. Like, it's beautiful. Like, it is. Yeah. Like, I know they've used small country towns and everything like that, rural towns, as they would call them in the States.
Yep.
But, yeah, they all look mint, beautifully.
They do, don't they? They sure do.
Yeah, especially in Chicago. Chicago looks amazing. I think they always use that one street. I don't know where it's located, but I think that's where, like, in Untouchables, they throw Frank Nitti off the roof. But yeah, it just looks fantastic, and I love seeing it.
Yeah, it's so great, isn't it?
Especially in digital. In digital,
yeah,
it looks fantastic.
It does, doesn't it? And I think it's interesting too, like seeing what the film took. When you see the films that it opened up against, it's actually really surprising that it took such a big box office taking.
Yeah.
So not sure who made the choice around when to release Public Enemies, but they actually opened the film on the same day as Transformers Revenge of the Fallen and Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs.
Ah, so it picks up the leftovers. Like, so do you remember the proposal?
Yes, I do, Craig.
Yeah, and for a while there, that was the actual, heaps of people were doing it, especially with Sandra Bullock movies. They were dropping them as the, and they do it still, they drop them as the alternative.
Yeah.
And it would be, like, if you're there, you're like, I don't want to see robot shit. I don't want to see Ice Age. Ooh, Johnny Depp with a machine gun.
Yeah, totally. I do agree, Craig. So I think the fact that it opened against those, so it was the third highest grossing film of that weekend.
Ah, fantastic.
And the fact that we get over $200 million opening up against both films, both Transformers and Ice Age are in the top five films.
Paramount and grossing. Sony?
Paramount, yeah, and Sony. Mm. Go Craig.
Fantastic. Look at me.
So the film took a decent return. When you think about budget and also marketing costs, probably made a little bit of money.
Good.
Not too much, but it received generally good reviews. Sort of those above average sort of scores were what it was getting. Your B's. Sort of 65 to 70%. But the critical reviews of the film generally praise the performances of both Johnny Depp and Billy Crudup in this film.
Billy Crudup.
So, I love Billy Crudup. So really
underrated
before we,
actor.
Oh, 100% Craig. I love him. I'm just going to go there right now. We've talked about him before on this podcast. He was incredible as Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen.
He's just a damn good actor. Just a damn good actor. Just one of those, every scene he's in, he's always just holds his own against, I don't care who's there.
100% Craig, I agree. I love it. And watch him in Zack Snyder's Justice League. He is so great as...
is he in this Flash?
I don't know. Hey, did you catch that trailer this week, Craig?
Oh, yeah, man. I watched all the DC trailers, man. They were hardcore.
Oh, hard. Sweet.
I did get a
Jesus.
Very controversial message from one of my friends. And I'd like you to actually elaborate on that, please, Jeff.
Me? What did I say?
You were
the Batman.
Yeah.
Look, I am someone who has stood up for Robert Pattinson since day one.
I see exactly what you mean, though.
I've been known to call him the next Brad Pitt, and I was really happy when he started getting a few little box office runs that were really great. He had some great performances. But I watched the Batman trailer, and it is so darn good. I'm on board for the vibe. Like, Colin Farrell looks incredible in this film.
Oh, I know.
So,
and that's not even going to be his end look.
No, it's not. And like we're setting things up. Matt Reeves is going to pump a trilogy here for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
The weakest part of the trailer is Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, and there is a couple of parts where you just go, ugh.
Oh, even like there's one thing. I watched it like three or four times because I couldn't understand what he said. There's one moment
what did he say?
At the window and he punches it.
Yeah, and he goes, blah.
No idea, Craig. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to see a Batman.
I should have gone
captions
then. I should have gone subtitles.
But I just wondered, it sounded almost like it had been digitally altered in a way so you don't, maybe it's a plot point.
Yeah.
And they don't want to drop a spoiler.
The Joker did it.
Yeah. Or something like, where is she? And you know that they're going to kidnap
where
someone.
Is she?
So I don't know. But yes, unfortunately, that was the thing that made me go, ugh. But I got so much faith in Matt Reeves as a filmmaker.
Oh, the action sequences just look fantastic.
Planet of the Apes films, I'm so stoked for this one. So I'm really psyched. So, Craig, before we get too far into DC world and sidetracked here.
Yeah, true.
Let's take a look at what the cinematic landscape was like in 2009. That's right. It's a fascinating year for film, actually. And the reason it's so fascinating is that in 2007 and 2008, Hollywood saw the writer's strike put a lot of projects on hold.
Yeah, it would have, yeah.
The result was a lot of projects fell apart. A lot of projects got put on sort of turnaround just until someone else could pay writers to work on it.
Yep.
Some projects, directors came on board and decided they would write them themselves. And Revenge of the Fallen is one of those where Michael Bay was very prominent in the writing of that second Transformers film. And you really sort of see that on the screen.
I keep forgetting which one's that. Is that the Balls one?
Revenge of the Fallen is that one. It's
I thought
the one
that was
the
third one.
Oh, maybe it is. Revenge of the Fallen is the one with the Australian girl.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And she has the robotic tongue that comes out and does
skinny
all that
girl.
Sort of stuff. Yeah, and
I think she had a mad story about the beef.
Oh, did she? Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. But so a lot of these projects, they're sort of partially written. And then even like I'm pretty sure Quantum of Solace is a product of the writer's strike and the director Mark Foster and Daniel Craig were the ones that finished writing the film. So a lot of these people didn't get credit for their work, but it meant that once they got to a certain part of production, they couldn't bring writers in to continue working on the script, as is pretty much the norm. So in addition to this, it has to be one of these amazing years where there's actually a stack of really good films as well as these sort of interesting half-good films.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of films that I really I still love revisiting now. And we've actually talked – this is the most – films we've talked about on this podcast come out of 2009.
Ooh, this is good. I'm ready.
At number one, Craig, taking $2.74 billion at the box office. Nominated for 9 Oscar awards, winning 3, was James Cameron's Avatar.
Oh, we were talking about that the other day.
Such a great film.
Oh man, I've got to rewatch it.
Oh, you should come over and watch it in 3D, Craig. It's like holds up so strong.
It would hold up. I imagine it holds up perfectly.
Yeah, it's seriously, and the animation in it and the visual effects, which it won an Academy Award for Best Art Direction and Best Visual Effects, is so good that it hasn't dated despite being, you know, 10 plus years old now.
Damn.
It's just so great. At number two, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Yep, good film. Damn good film.
Number three, Ice Age Dawn of Dinosaurs, followed at number four by Transformers Revenge of the Fallen.
Oh, there, yeah. What a big weekend that was.
At number five was John Cusack in 2012.
Oh, love it.
I'm throwing it out there, Craig. I think as a little post-season treat, we should record a 2012 episode.
I'm terrified of 2012. Don't get me fucking near it.
At number six was Pixar's Up.
Yep.
Love that film. At number seven, The Twilight Saga New Moon. So it's the second film in the Twilight Saga.
Go Robert.
Number eight, Guy Ritchie drops Sherlock Holmes.
Still fantastic, man.
Yep.
Still fantastic.
Number nine, we've talked about on the podcast before, Ron Howard's Angels and Demons.
Yeah. Damn good.
Yeah, damn good.
Still got to watch that series.
Yeah, I haven't checked it out yet. At number 10 was The Hangover.
Oh, fantastic.
So, like I mentioned, with the inclusion now of Public Enemies, we've had 6 films from 2009 we've talked about on the podcast. Considering this is our 7th season, the only director not to drop a film in this time is Joe Carnahan.
Oh, really? Jojo?
Yeah. And it's because the A-Team was somewhat delayed. And so we've spoken about Angels and Demons we talked about already. We also covered Robert Zemeckis' A Christmas Carol.
Yep.
Zack Snyder's Watchmen.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
This was a Billy Crudup year.
Sam Raimi had Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, man. Hardcore film.
And we have the Catherine Bigelow directed The Hurt Locker.
Man, this was a fucking fantastic year.
Yeah, so Hurt Locker along with Avatar were the Oscar darlings of the year. Hurt Locker was also nominated for 9 Academy Awards and won 6, including Best Director, which was really huge because Catherine Bigelow was the first female to ever win a Best Director. It won Best Picture, Best Original Screenplay, Best Film Editing, Best Sound Editing, and Best Sound Mixing.
Damn.
The Hurt Locker. Now, this was also a really fascinating year for the Oscars because this is the first year that they went from Best Picture used to be limited to 5 entries. And this is the year that it expanded to, I think it might be 10 entries.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, something like that. So it's expanded at this point to a bigger amount. So also released, and I'll rip through a few of these, was Liam Neeson in Taken.
Yep.
We got the fantastic Coraline.
Oh, man. Seriously, it just had that. I just love it too much, Coraline. seriously, it is one of the best. Like, we watch a lot of R.L. Stein in this house from, you know, Disney Plus. They must have a deal with him. But, and I was telling you, Mark Webb is directing some of the.
Yeah, poor old Webby.
Yeah, good old Webb. I hope he gets out of it. He's a talented
Me
director.
Me too.
But, but Coraline is still my favorite kids horror movie. You know what I mean? It has the perfect amount of just fear and just excitement that I think a kid would really, really appreciate.
Well, and my adults. Boy does. And adults, Craig.
Oh, man, seriously. We Carter had Coraline shirts. He loves them.
Also released was the fourth installment to Fast and the Furious saga. Really important one because this is where it took it the direction of it's all about the family now and not so much about the racing.
Is this when
Justin Lin came on board to direct and really took it in the direction that the franchise is headed now? Also released was State of Play, which featured Russell Crowe and Ben Affleck.
I still haven't seen it.
Really good. A great, great thriller, Craig. Check that one out. The infamous X-Men Origins Wolverine was released. Real shame because I honestly believe Gavin Hood is a talented director.
If you watch same.
Ender's Game's a stack of fun. He's done a whole heap of other work that's fantastic. J.J. Abrams released Star Trek.
Fantastic, man.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
This is also
we're killing it at Cinefalls around this time, aren't we?
Cinefalls are ripping it this
year. Yeah, because I remember all these ones we had interviews or some type of storyline around it.
We're at the world premiere of Star Trek.
Black Tie. Right. We love you, Michael.
Yeah, we love you, Michael. Craig took a chatted to Ruby Rose before she was Ruby Rose.
Yeah, before she became just that, you know, stereotype short haired villain, female villain.
Yeah. Also released was Terminator Salvation, which is a little bit of an underrated entry into the franchise, I reckon. McGee
it's just
does a great
Sam
job.
Sam Worthy can't put on an accent.
Unfortunately.
Just an Aussie robot.
The very hilarious Land of the Lost was released.
I still love that movie. I think it's one of the fucking funniest movies ever.
Yeah, it is so funny.
I've lived.
Oh, I forgot about the slide down the back of the dinosaur.
Slides down the back of that dinosaur's tail?
Like Fred Flintstone.
I've lived. Danny McBride, he's one of my favorite roles of his. And it's nowhere, and the movie isn't crude at all. Like, you know what I mean? Apart from Chucker.
Yeah.
it's such a funny movie, man. Fuck, I've got to watch it now.
My memory of Land of the Lost will always be Lincoln Lewis, who went on to be, he actually starred in Stuart Beattie's Tomorrow When the War Began.
Yeah.
He's sitting in the front row with a giant box of popcorn, just absolutely pooping himself laughing throughout the film. It was the best thing ever. Just one of those people, you know, where you see someone in real life and you're like, that dude has a lust for life. I just love it so much. Also released Duncan Jones's Moon featuring Sam Rockwell. Fantastic. Sacha Baron Cohen dropped Bruno. We also had Judd Apatow's Funny People, which is, you know, I absolutely love that film, Craig. Another film I really love, Julie and Julia.
Oh, really?
Amy Adams. Oh, man, I love that film. Stanley Tucci's in there. We've got Meryl Streep. Love the Tooch. Also released District 9.
Love it. I've been watching Neil Blomkamp's series on...
Netflix.
On Netflix.
Are they good?
Some of it is fucked up. They're good. They're all concept stories.
Yep.
And they're interesting, man. They're heaps interesting. Like, you could see where, like, obviously some of them are not meant to make sense. They're meant to be like little clips or concepts of a film. Yep. Man, seriously, hardcore. Pretty hardcore.
He's a talented director.
But in it, you almost see he's more of a talented
visual effects artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wondered the same thing because when you watch District 9, it is, and even like Chappie, which is a much maligned sort of entry into his filmography, the visual effects are always stunning in his films.
Yeah, there's a District 9 feel throughout the whole thing. It doesn't feel like he's really stepping too far away from the visual of District 9.
Yeah, okay.
But it's still good to watch. It's still good to watch.
So good. Also released, we'll fly through the rest, Inglourious Basterds. We've also got Paranormal Activity is released.
Never seen it.
The first Zombieland's released.
Loved it.
Sandra Bullock's in The Blind Side.
Oh, the good film. Very good film.
The incredible Where the Wild Things Are.
I love it. Still do. Soundtrack, fantastic.
And Peter Jackson's The Lovely Bones.
Oh, wow. Boom.
So this is an incredible year for film. And as I mentioned, Craig, maybe I've got a bit of nostalgia attached to those films because we were sort of reporting on them and covering them. And
meeting the actors and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but still, they're films that, like, I'll happily go and watch, like, Where the Wild Things Are. I'd go to watch that in an instant. Zombieland's a great, great lot of fun, you know. So there's a good content coming out of it despite the challenges with writing previously.
Yeah, true, very true. A lot of good talent found, like a lot of writer-directors, you know, especially Zombieland and all those. Yeah, they all just came out of that time.
So it's so good. So you can see it's got a good mix of blockbusters. It's got some good, some not so good, but heaps that we love. So as we mentioned previously, the early bones of Public Enemies is something that has really sort of sat throughout Michael Mann's career. It goes all the way back, as far back, Craig, as he was working on it during The Keep and Manhunter.
Dang.
So we're talking the 80s, Mann's working on it. And what it was a different sort of iteration. Mann's sort of developing a project based around Alvin Karpis. Now, for those who watched Public Enemies, that role's played by Giovanni Ribisi.
Yep.
And Karpis is sort of like the fence in the project. Yeah, in the film. So they're going to him for what jobs are going on. Have you heard anything that I could work on? Where's my next score? And Karpis is sort of pointing him in the right direction. Now, the reason that Mann's sort of fascinated is, along with John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Babyface Nelson, Alvin Karpis was listed as Public Enemy 1 by the FBI. But he is the only of the four who survived.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and when I started doing a bit of research on Karpis himself, he's got this fascinating, like, story that deserves a film, I think.
They're almost the last of the outlaws, hey?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, Craig. It's like, it really is. And what's incredible is that when you look into it, the times depicted here, which is really about the creation of the FBI and all that sort of stuff. Mm. All of this Wild West going on in the 30s takes place in about 18 months.
Damn.
So you'd think all this stuff going on is taking place over a long period of time. It's really just a brief snapshot of the era coming out of that sort of prohibition.
And depression era.
Yeah, and the depression era. And it really started this sort of Wild West this 18 months forced the creation of the FBI because it was just so out of control. So Karpis he really does have this fascinating thing. And I just wrote down a few little things that make you go, wow, this guy deserves to have like a TV show or a film written about him. Because like in 1934, Karpis has his fingerprints surgically removed so he couldn't be traced.
This guy's awesome.
He was arrested and imprisoned in Alcatraz and was actually like in Alcatraz along with Al Capone and a whole heap of those other like gangsters. Supposedly by this point, Capone was suffering really strongly from syphilis and was going mad in the prison. He was moved later from Alcatraz to a prison called McNeil Island Penitentiary. Now, that prison, he met a young man also imprisoned named Charles Manson. And really has this sort of 30 plus years, I think it's close to 40 years actually, that he's imprisoned amongst basically the who's who of people who were arrested. And so there's all this information. Now, despite all this fascinating stuff around Karpis, Mann just couldn't get the project to a place where he felt that the story and the script were suitable for him to move forward on it as a film. So he sort of puts the project on hold and moves on to work on a little project called The Last of the Mohicans.
Boom. Shit, is this far long ago, man? Yeah. Fucking hell.
So Mann sort of shelves it and his career moves on. And as people have heard, if this is your first episode, g'day, I'm Jeff.
I'm great.
And go back, listen to all the other stuff, the amazing work that Michael Mann's done between then to now.
And the amazing work we've done. from then to now.
That's true. That's true. That's right. It's worth a listen. But it's sort of the project around Alvin Karpis starts sort of, it just sits. And as we've learnt, Michael Mann's often thinking about past projects or ideas that he's been developing, and they sort of rattle around his brain. So we're going to fast forward now to 2004. And this is the year that Collateral gets released. And so in 2004, a man named Brian Burrow releases a nonfiction book entitled Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933 to 1934. Now, at the time, Burrow was a writer for the Wall Street Journal. Not at the time, but he was a writer for the Wall Street Journal through the 80s and early 90s and had written a few other nonfiction books. Now, the idea that he had for this book originally started as a TV miniseries idea that Burrow had. So he actually pitched the idea of this as a mini series to HBO, and HBO loved the idea, and Burrow was made executive producer, aka showrunner, and was asked to write a screenplay for this miniseries. Now he was partnering with Robert De Niro's Tribeca Productions on it as well. So it's got a little bit of clout.
It's got a lot of backing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of people must be confident in this idea.
Yeah, very much so. Now, Burrow had never written a screenplay before in his life. So he sets out writing a few drafts for the film or the miniseries. And when interviewed about them, he says that they were terrible.
He's probably just like all the HBO and like, yeah, that's a great idea. You know, De Niro's calling him, that's a great idea. Hangs up the phone and goes, oh, fuck, I don't know how to do this.
Totally.
Well, he says, Googling, what is a screenplay?
Screenplays for dummies. So he wrote a few drafts of the series and was asked later, how bad were they? And he goes, they were terrible. They were so bad, I think they were Ishtar bad.
Oh, really? Imagine what Michael Mann would have said about it. That would have been awesome.
So the miniseries falls apart and Burrow sort of thinks about it and goes, oh, I think I'm probably going to be a bit more comfortable making this into one of these nonfiction books that I've already released. At this stage, he'd released three nonfiction books in the past. And so he starts using the idea and research that he had to write the book. And he spends 2 years writing the book. Now, before the book's release, Burroughs actually approaches HBO and asks if it would be okay for them to release back to him the rights for the movie. And for him, very luckily, and for us, I guess luckily, HBO agreed to this and give him the rights to the book again.
Awesome.
So he's got the rights to this. Now, around this time, Michael Mann starts learning of Burrow's work through a Vanity Fair article that featured extracts from his upcoming book. And following the book's release, Michael Mann moves pretty quickly to gain the rights of a movie based upon the book. Now, Mann also, his production company partners with Leonardo DiCaprio's production company to buy the rights together.
Jeez.
So they start developing this film with intention of Leonardo DiCaprio starring as John Dillinger.
Oh.
Now, going back to 2004, during this time, while this is all going on, Mann finishes his work on Collateral and, as we've heard, starts pursuing Tonight He Comes as sort of the next project that he'll work on. So throughout this, he's still researching and developing Public Enemies. And we'll fast forward a little bit here, Craig, to 2006, which is when Mann brings on a man named Ronan Bennett to write the project. Now, Bennett's pretty fascinating as well, and we have talked about him. We haven't talked about him yet, but he has been involved with Michael Mann previously, and this was a real fascinating one that I sort of dug up along my research for this episode. So Bennett was a journalist who he actually had been falsely imprisoned in Northern Ireland and served time in a Northern Irish prison.
Oh, Jesus. So he's a little bit tough.
He's pretty darn tough. And he'd also written a Che Guevara project for Michael Mann.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, Mann was looking to release this sort of a bit before. It's probably in that period around Ali and The Insider. And Mann pulled the plug on the project once he heard that Steven Soderbergh was developing his two Che Guevara movies.
I still haven't seen those.
Oh, they're so good, Craig. Like, they're Benicio? Really good. Yeah, Benicio del Toro. Two very different films, but they work so beautifully together. Hey, they're definitely worth a look. So, Bennett spends the next sort of 18 months adapting Burroughs' book, and after a number of drafts, Mann feels it's at the point where they're ready to start really working on the project. So, as Michael Mann does, he brings on another writer named Anne Biderman to work with himself, being Michael Mann, at rewriting the script and polishing it before they shot the film. Now, Anne Biderman is also a really renowned writer. She had, at that point, had done a lot of work in television, primarily did a lot of work on NYPD Blue.
Oh, that's good. That's good writing.
And then moved on to write the film's Copycat, which...
I didn't mind it.
It wasn't bad. Harry Connick Jr. is man.
He was impressive. I always think about it, you know, because she's got agoraphobia, and I always thought it was a pretty good film. Who was the other girl in it?
Ooh, that wasn't Jodie Foster, was it?
I keep thinking that, but I don't think it was.
Interesting.
Hmm.
I don't know. Look it up, Craig.
To the IMDb and then go, and I'll just interrupt you.
After Copycat, her next film that was written and released was Primal Fear.
Oh, this lady is fantastic. I love her.
So, and as Holly Hunter. Holly Hunter. So good. Great work, Craig. Later, Biderman would then go on to create TV shows such as Southland and Ray Donovan.
Oh, really? Ray Donovan. Yeah. Everyone loves it, man. My brother Frank is fucking just crazy on Ray Donovan.
I heard Liev Schreiber's amazing in it, too.
I've watched two episodes, and it's pretty fantastic. He's like a fixer, like a Hollywood fixer.
So
you know?
Good.
But, and his family are fucked up, as always. But, yeah, I didn't get too much into it.
Well, even when you look up Southland, it really, when I read the synopsis, it basically reads like one of those 80s, 90s Michael Mann TV shows.
What is Southland?
It's basically like a gritty sort of LA cop show. Mm. And so it literally could have copied and pasted from like Crime Story or something like that. And it's you could see why it sort of is something that
her and Michael Mann are perfect.
That's right. So around this time, Craig, DiCaprio departs the project to focus on another collaboration with Martin Scorsese. So he's left Public Enemies now to go on and make Shutter Island.
Perfect. Love that film.
And with DiCaprio no longer attached, they start beginning the casting process. And so as we sort of talked about, 2007, 2008 is this challenging time for films. And it actually saw a lot of projects fall apart or get delayed. And so suddenly these big name actors who were booked up for years in advance have got these windows to make films. And it really works in favor, thanks to the writer's strike, for Public Enemies, because Johnny Depp had been attached to a long gestating screen adaptation of the massive novel Shantaram.
Oh, yes. God, I remember that too.
Yeah, and so the writer's strike pretty much killed that film. Mm-hmm. Now, I also learnt that it's actually about to be released as an Apple TV TV series.
Oh, really?
Shantaram. Yeah, starring Charlie Hunnam and Tony Collette.
Oh, Charlie. Oh, so, okay, so because Charlie's working on a project where one of the directors is from Maitland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he got one of the director's kids. One of the director's kid's teacher is a huge Charlie Hunnam fan.
Yeah.
And the director got Charlie Hunnam to go to say hello to her. Like it's that's a greeter so school or some shit, weird shit like that. Like, and he's like, hello, you know, and he's like, oh my God. Yeah. I don't know if it's Shantaram, but yeah.
I think because they're filming it in Australia, so it makes a ton of sense.
Sounds perfect then, yep.
Well, that's really cool. So Shantaram does have life now, but at that point it had died as a film. And another film that was greatly affected was Rob Marshall's musical Nine. Now, I don't know if you saw Nine. It starred Daniel Day-Lewis. But Marion Cotillard has a role in it, as well as Penelope Cruz, Kate Hudson, and a whole heap of other amazing actors. I think Judi Dench is in there as well. So the film gets delayed as a result of the writer's strike, meaning that Marion Cotillard is looking for new projects to be a part of.
Cool.
So then enter Michael Mann and his little gangster film called Public Enemies. So in January 2008, Christian Bale's announced by Variety that he's joined the cast and that filming will start in March 2008. And March 2008, just before filming, they announced the last sort of castings, your David Wenhams, your Channing Tatums, you know, all those sort of smaller parts that are throughout the film get announced.
Stephen Dorff,
who I quite enjoyed in this film.
Yeah.
But filming kicks off on the 17th of March and runs all the way through to sort of the end of May 2008. So talking just probably 3 solid months worth of filming.
That's
now,
good.
As we mentioned, the film itself was released 1st of July 2009. Had a pretty sort of okay reviews and a bit of a financial success. Now, that's the journey to screen, Craig. I'd love to know, when was the last time you watched this film?
Had to be the movies, hey.
Yeah, wow.
Had
2009?
To be the movies. Yeah, definitely, because I've never bought it.
So interesting.
Never bought it. I don't know why. I don't remember ever walking out of the... I don't ever remember walking out of the cinema with bad taste in my mouth. I just basically just... Yeah, I don't know. I mustn't have liked it or I would have bought it. Especially during our peak years where I just bought everything. There must have been something that I just disliked about it.
It is an interesting film because I think when it was released, I remember it being something people felt they didn't get the way that it was advertised. So the product you saw in cinemas, the film made it look like this epic sort of Bonnie and Clyde sort of story. And I don't think you necessarily got that. So I think a lot of people, upon seeing it in cinemas, were sort of like a bit, that just wasn't what I wanted, you know?
Yeah, but exactly.
I'm going to say it just from the get-go, Craig. This film super holds up.
It does hold up. But there's part of it that just, I don't know, I couldn't get into. I don't know why. It was
so
weird. I think it might have been my head.
I have been just absolutely in turmoil about where I'm going to put this on the ranking chart, Craig, because I flat out loved this film.
Really?
This is like legitimately my dark horse surprise packet, and I've probably said that already, but I thought this film, from my response, so the last time I watched this, I bought this when it was released on Blu-ray, so we're probably talking 2010. Before the great film logging of 2011 and beyond. I remember watching it and it just didn't feel like it was there for me, but I still enjoyed it enough to buy it. But so I guess we'll get into what we expected. And what I really expected from this film was, my memory was that it was a film that should have been better than it was.
Yeah.
It was a film that seemed to drag, and it was a film that sold me on the gangsters, but I didn't get enough gangsters. But I definitely got way more than that. I really enjoyed it so much. What did you expect, Craig?
Oh, look, I expected something. I expected a great revisit. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted it to be like what you had. I wanted it to be that big surprise for me. But it's really conflicting for me, man. When I think back on it, I think, you know, I can think of positive things through it. But then there's also just parts of it where I was just incredibly bored.
Really?
Yeah, man, where I was just like, there's just something about it that just made me sleepy, that I just could not sleepy. It didn't seem like it had a spark to it. It seemed lifeless to me. Like, it seemed like an amazing imitation of a human film.
Wow. Wow. That is huge, Craig. It's so interesting to me because, like, to me, this film was like literally, you know how many notes I write when I'm watching a film? I've got, like, just screens and screens of stuff that I'm typing all the time. I literally got, like, four lines into writing notes and I put my phone down. And wow. I was just, like, I was on board the whole time. It was, like, I guess there's just... For me, the story around Dillinger was fascinating and I actually wanted more of not gangster Dillinger, so I didn't need to see all the heists. I didn't need all that.
But not even that. It's just even some it just some of the chemistry didn't click with me. That's what I'm saying.
Was it did Depp and Cotillard?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like some of that didn't click. You know what I mean? Like the Which is weird because there's such amazing actors through this film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What
like
a
Christian
cast.
Bale, you know, your Christian Bale, Johnny Depp scenes and stuff like that. None of that just hit right to me. It just seemed like a sneer.
So interesting.
I know, actually, it's weird, eh? I'm just weird. I'm weirded out by my whole experience with Public Enemy. Sorry, keep going on.
No, it's okay because... Like, Crudup is so good in this film.
Amazing.
You can't talk this film
without
talking
Crudup.
Fucking love Crudup. As, yeah, he's just so darn good in this. And I think that probably took me a bit by surprise. I wasn't expecting as much about the creation of the FBI.
Yes.
And so I guess when you see a film that has Johnny Depp on the cover and he's hanging out of the car with the machine gun, you think this is... And it's sold as the John Dillinger film.
It is. Well, that's in essence what it... You know, you look at all the synopsises and they sell it as this John Dillinger.
But, like, I guess when you really break the film down, it's two storylines going on at once. And perhaps what I think failed its marketing... was that when people got the moments that wasn't about Dillinger, they're like, ugh, I don't care about this guy. But I guess if there was something to say they could have developed a bit better, maybe the blending of, you know, if we're to talk a scale of weight in storylines, the Dillinger versus FBI, I really love it, Craig. So I'm happy with how much there is.
I'm going to say one of the most controversial lines I've ever said about something in film.
Do it.
I don't think Johnny Depp was likable enough.
Do you know what, Craig? I don't think that is.
You know what? I just don't think... He was a very... It just... Cool.
Can I say...
As like you said, on the poster, you take any still from the whole entire movie, the man fits it perfectly. He has the matinee look. He has the matinee clothes. He has even the matinee voice. But his eyes seem dead through the whole film.
I will give you that, Craig. I will definitely give you that. And do you know what? I think editing has hurt this film in that sense. So, you know where,
I would have loved to see him and Maura Marion Cotillard.
When he picks up Carrie Mullington, or is it Casey Mullington? Who's the blonde girl they pick up very early in the film? He puts her in the back of the car.
I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember her name, no.
Terrible, promising young woman. She's an amazing actor.
Carrie Mulligan, is it?
I'm pretty sure. I'm going to have to look right now, Craig. But anyways.
This girl was... That's not Carrie Mulligan because she would have been... She's young, man. She would have been like in her teens at that time.
You sure?
This girl is the one, Greta or Gretchen Moll?
Carrie Mulligan.
Fuck, is she?
Yeah, it totally was.
Okay.
So, yeah, when he picks her up, there's that moment in the car where he's sort of like, you can tell there's something between the two of them.
Yeah.
And I did read that in editing that she talks about in interviews later as well. In editing, they cut out scenes where he's kissing her. So I think what you actually lose is, and what we needed to establish early in the film, that probably it does let it down a little bit, is that Dillinger isn't seen as, he's meant to be that person that they all love. Like, America was in love with him at the same time as he's terrorizing the nation, you know? So he's got this, he's almost like the modern Robin Hood.
Well, he is, because this is, like we said, this is a time out of the Great Depression. So all the banks are foreclosing businesses and farms. And suddenly here comes this guy who's just robbing banks.
Yeah.
And so they just saw it just as a guy taking from the, you know, just taking from the man.
Yeah. I love it. And I guess we probably, we miss a few moments of that that are so crucial to establishing that. Like, again, when we get to that moment where he's arrested and they're holding the press conference and he's being like a real cheeky sort of person in the press conference, you know, even the way he sort of hams it up and directs it, you know, you want to see that. And they, like, when you do some research in it, he didn't necessarily walk into the building, that moment where he walks into the police precinct and they're all watching the baseball game. That wasn't something that happened. But Dillinger was known to walk to crime scenes, to pose for photos within places.
Well, that scene where Marion Cotillard gets arrested and he's just across the road is true.
Oh, man. And
it's true. I remember looking it up and going, surely these guys aren't that dumb that they can't see fucking John Dillinger across the road. And I thought that was one of the, I remember coming out of the theater going, that's one of the dumbest scenes I've ever seen. But it's true.
It's incredible. And can we just take a moment and say, how good is Marion Cotillard in those interrogation scenes following her arrest?
Ah, seriously, fantastic. And how good's that dude? He just looks like a meathead.
Oh, doesn't he what? Hey, can we, before we get too far away from it, let's just circle back to Johnny Depp, because I want to agree with you, Craig. Johnny Depp is, he's a draw card to a film still at this stage.
Yep.
And we're probably in the middle of or kicking off Pirates of the Caribbean at this stage, would we?
Yeah, round about, yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe we could assume that Johnny Depp is having some of his struggles. You know, he's had a couple life struggles going on throughout that franchise, talking about some dependency issues and addictions. So maybe this is playing a factor, but
it just feels like he didn't get, it feels like it's not Johnny Depp.
It's interesting, but I'm going to agree with you, Craig, because I love Johnny Depp, so I'm just saying it from the get-go. I love Johnny Depp. But today, we've been doing a little bit of a movie cull in the Reed House.
Yeah.
So we've been selling a few old DVDs that have been lying around. And lately, I bought a pack just through an online sort of purchase that someone was doing, like, I was really interested in other movies, and I got given City of Lies, which was the DVD version of the Who
the
Shot
Tupac,
you know, that sort of thing. And I looked at the poster today because I was about to hand it over to someone, and it says Academy Award nominee above Johnny Depp and Academy Award winner above Forest Whitaker. And at first I was surprised. I was like, Johnny Depp's never won an Academy Award? And then I started doing the mental sort of notes, and I'm like, actually, is there a performance that Johnny Depp's been in that you would say is good enough to be included in the Oscars?
Well, I always said that Johnny Depp suffers from his charisma. So that's always been my issue with Johnny Depp, that it's the same with Harrison Ford to an extent. I know Harrison Ford is a stretch or something, but they're always playing, like, Harrison Ford is always playing Harrison Ford. Johnny Depp is always playing Johnny Depp. I would say the closest Johnny Depp's ever gotten, and it was only not long ago to me, it was, look, I'm just trying to find it now. It's the one where basically Black Mass.
Oh, he was so good.
Where
he
plays Whitey Bulger, and that is fantastic. He actually plays against type a lot there, but most of his films, so Public Enemies is in between The Imaginary of Dr. Parnassus, this is after Sweeney Todd, and then he goes on to Alice in Wonderland. So this is basically, you know what I mean, like.
He's moving from serious actor to popcorn actor, isn't he?
Oh, I think his move to popcorn actor was very, I think in his defense, I think he really fell into popcorn actor just because he follows Tim Burton, and Tim Burton really falls, just moves into those roles. He just became more popular. I'm just disappointed in how he played this character. Yeah. I just, for Johnny Depp, I expect just likable. You know what I mean? You know, and I guess like he may have been playing it, you know, like this, because John Dillinger obviously was a sociopath. Yes. Most of them are. And he probably played it to type, but it's not.
You can see where.
Yeah.
You can see where DiCaprio would shine in this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. DiCaprio, look, there's more nuance in DiCaprio than you'll ever get out of Johnny Depp. And you know, there'd be people out there who may hate me for that, but it's DiCaprio. But yeah, Johnny Depp, I was just, but man, fuck, he looks the part. He amazingly looks the part. Like, he's a beautiful looking dude. And that time in the world, like that, you know, and that beautiful digital, every frame with him in it, he looks impeccable.
I did a bit of a Google as well today. I can't remember what I was just looking up something about Johnny Depp. I did Johnny Depp Public Enemies, and I just wanted some facts around, just do a little last minute fact checking. And the second Google search that comes up in the preemptive text was Johnny Depp Public Enemies haircut. And that's like how much he looks the part, is that his haircut is this thing, as I search, that people often go into barbers and go, hey, I want the Johnny Depp Public Enemies fade, please.
That's a nice haircut. I remember noticing it going, oh, yeah. And Dillinger had a similar haircut.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Which is all.
Imagine just a big, you know, a big Samoan or Maori giving him that fade. Yeah, bro, you're going to look goody. Yeah, when you're going into the Knicks, they robbed that bank. Yeah, fuck, bro. Yeah, just a fade up the side, just a little cut down the side there, bro.
I saw a very funny, in Australia, there is a parody page on Facebook that does fake news. And it's intentionally fake news, called the Batuta Advocate. And
I love the Batuta.
They had a hilarious thing because in Australia we are suddenly finding ourselves coming out of lockdown, and so parts of Sydney that have been locked down for quite a long time have been given some freedoms. And so it said Western Sydney barbers clippers start combusting as he finishes his 147th fade for the day. really funny. Just in case you were wondering, Craig, Johnny Depp's actually been nominated for Best Actor 3 times. Academy Awards. His first nomination was for Jack Sparrow in the first Pirates of the Caribbean film in 2004.
Very true. At least deserved a nomination.
This is one that I'm surprised that I didn't think of, which is probably speaks volumes for how much other stuff for Johnny Depp there is to overshadow it, in terms of you'd forget that this great performance was in
Tonto.
was Finding Neverland.
Yeah.
He's really good. He's so much heart in that film. And the other one he was nominated for was Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd was pretty hardcore, man.
But
the
Sweeney
gore
Todd
really got me over the rest of it. But yeah, that's right. He sings in it, hey?
Yeah, yeah. Good. So, so good. And as you mentioned, a lot of people are upset because they think Black Mass was actually his best performance and most deserving of Oscar.
Man, he's unrecognizable. That's why I love it. Like, that's like true. Johnny Depp has always pushed away from that glamour boy look. And you always appreciate that because he's just gone off kilter a bit. But that film is the one where he's not Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And that is, and he's great in it. I think he's great in it.
So damn good. He's also, like, I find a lot of the times, maybe he's such a good actor that he lets other people shine around him. But if you look at films that he's been in, there's usually another actor that you think, oh, man, they were good in that. You know, take What's Eating Gilbert Grape. He's got DiCaprio going over the top next to him, you know. And all these films, aside from sort of your Public Enemies, or not your Public Enemies, your Pirates of the Caribbean, and probably Sweeney Todd. Like, even Finding Neverland, everyone praised Freddie Highmore for that. You know, like, he was such a beautiful young actor that everyone was just like, oh man, what a great actor this kid is, you know? And so I think maybe that's something for Johnny Depp. But we're probably getting a bit caught on old Johnny and forgetting about the whole film itself, Craig.
But like Johnny is the linchpin of the film.
Yes.
Because he's Dillinger. And Dillinger, the whole concept of the film is lost if you don't understand Dillinger. Because yeah. Dillinger is meant to represent the... Because as most outlaws do, most outlaws, like even like Robin Hood, are meant to represent the culture of that time. You know what I mean? They represent the injustices of that time. And so did he. And that's what was he... But... And that's why it's so important that he should have nailed it.
Yeah, I love it.
Because you don't understand why someone like Marion Cotillard would be so heartbroken over him.
Yeah, and you know, because
that's not built in too much.
Yeah, totally, Craig. I love it. Can we take a moment as well? Like, the fact that there are four Public Enemy number one, I was surprised how...
Oh, is there?
Four Public Enemy number ones, yeah.
So they can all be number ones?
Yeah, so I think
it's not like there's like your Public Enemy number two. Like, I'm not being a smartass. I'm really not. I just thought like he was
maybe
one.
Maybe it's after one dies and then the other one goes up to number one.
Because I know there's the FBI top 10 list and there is the FBI number one, which you would assume is Public Enemy number one. But I didn't realize, okay. So it's not like really a designation as much as a category.
I wonder if it's more about the authority they have if they see that person.
Yeah, exactly. Like a category, you know, you've reached level fucking emergency, level shoot on site type thing.
Yeah, okay, and cool. So I was surprised in it that Pretty Boy Floyd was given so little time considering he was on the same level as Dillinger in the FBI's eyes.
Yeah.
Which is when it's our introduction to Christian Bale as Purvis is... pretty much just chasing Channing Tatum through the orchard.
People were shocked about that.
Well, because Channing Tatum, again, was like, he was potentially the next, you know, poster boy.
Yeah.
You know, he was huge out of step up. And for him to get a chance in a Michael Mann film to be on for like, I don't know, 2 minutes.
I was talking about the actual shooting.
Oh, okay.
So Melvin Purvis, obviously, there's debate about
in real
Melvin.
Life.
Yeah, in real life. So the Melvin Purvis is Christian Bale's role. He once again, he was one of the last of the friggin' Wyatt Earps of that time. and there's a lot of, and he said he single handedly, you know, shot him. But there's some conflicting results, like some conflicting stories. Like some people say, obviously it was a group effort. And others say that they shot him while he was only wounded, but he made sure that they shot him in cold blood. They'll wipe him out completely. Yeah. But Melvin Purvis, man, he was a hardcore dude. You know, after he left the FBI, he joined World War II. He became an intelligence officer who helped actually gather evidence for the Nuremberg trials.
Wow.
I know, eh? And then died by death by misadventure, which basically means that he accidentally shot himself.
Oh,
when he
really?
Was like 50, 60 or something. Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
I know his son or his nephew released couple of books afterwards because supposedly J. Edgar Hoover started to get really upset because a lot of people were focusing more on Purvis as the national hero because he even got special awards from senators and everything like that.
Wow.
And it took away from J. Edgar Hoover's spotlight. And so he actually got taken off the case against John Dillinger there for a while.
Wow.
He got taken off the case for a little bit before he found that and they gave it to someone else who then got killed or quit or something like that. And then Purvis came back on.
It's so interesting too because I do love in the film that there's that tension playing out through the film between both Purvis and Hoover.
Yeah, I know. It's good, isn't it? It's good.
It's so. That's probably I'd say that's probably the most believable relationship in the film.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much chemistry between those two, whether it is in a negative sense or not. But it was, yeah, I love it. I do love, too, Purvis, like the way Christian Bale plays Purvis. Just reminds me of Rex Banner in that Simpsons episode.
100%, 100%. But it is, and he does play that so straight, like he's like on a TV show. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Like the TV show out at LA Confidential. Sorry, lady, just the facts.
Yeah,
you know what
totally.
I mean? Just go, oh God, show a bit of, like, and it was once again he's sort of disappointing as well. I wish they actually showed a little bit more about who Purvis was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It would have boosted up the, because he really just, he was almost like the Terminator hunting him. He had not much, obviously there wasn't much, I don't know, build up between both personalities coming and clashing, yeah. Which it should have been, you know what I mean? Like, in my mind, it should have been that clash of this, you know, guy, you know, I guess you're looking for that clash because I'm comparing it to Heat.
Yeah, and
we've got to
make sure that we. It's hard because they're not saying this in. If I'm a general punter going to watch this film,
yeah,
I'm not doing research to make sure I know this is based on a book that is actually chronicling just 18 months.
Yeah,
in US history, so it's hard because, you know, we go, oh, I wish we'd saw Pretty Boy Floyd a bit more in the film, but. It's probably likely that very early on, Pretty Boy Floyd was killed in that time period. We don't get much of Purvis because he's literally just brought in during this time period to the creation of the FBI and is working under Hoover. Probably we could have seen a few more conflict between Hoover and Purvis to really play out what sort of person Purvis is in those moments.
Oh, well, but, I guess we're used to the dueling characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's such an amazing, he captures duality so amazingly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like Fox and Cruise and, like we said, Pacino and De Niro. Yeah. You know, and even De Niro, even Pacino and Crow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And totally. So, yeah, you just, I just, that's what I expected so much. I wanted that.
Tell me, like, so just taking that and expanding a bit on it, Craig, Are there many Michael Mann moments in this film for you?
Oh, there's plenty. There's plenty of Michael Mann moments. Like, you know what I mean? It just has, I would say it has the similar coldness of Miami Vice.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Like, and that's where you wonder, that's what I seriously was coming in here going, okay, Jeff's going to tell me that fucking everyone hated it on set, you know, you know, something crazy was going on because it has that coldness. There's not that, and I guess there's not many of that lighthearted moments as well in this, you know, and once again, I'm not looking for a freaking Marvel movie. I'm just basically saying, like, there's no enjoyment. There's hardly no any enjoyment. There is some enjoyment, like when they're doing escapes, you know, you get your heart racing, you know, they're jumping on the car and stuff like that. But there's really no enjoyment that you really want that breaks up the mood of it a bit more.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And I expect a little bit more of that.
It's hard too, because in this time setting, I think we've been so spoilt with films set in this era.
Yeah.
So you can't watch a film that looks and feels like you're in the same world as, say, The Shawshank Redemption. You know, and...
Yeah, that's true, man.
And not hope for the same moments of lightheartedness that appear in a film that can also be very dark.
Yeah.
And so I think its time period causes it to suffer a little bit. It's interesting because, for me, it harkens to another film. I think it's very similar to, this is almost a sister film in a way to Ali.
Yeah.
And I think in that sense, where I'm going with this is that in Ali, we felt the film suffered because it was set within a bookended time period. So we got a 10-year period of Muhammad Ali's life. We just wanted more of that life.
Yeah.
But we didn't quite get it. And unfortunately, we go, oh, man, I wish I saw more about his Cassius Clay time. I wish I knew more about what happened after the rumble in the jungle to really make that happen. And I think for me, because I really do still enjoy this film, even after we're pulling it apart a bit, Craig, I think what Michael Mann's done is gone, all right, we're going to still work within a time period, but how do we make this a bit more cohesive? And unfortunately, probably what where the film suffers is there's a coldness that's given to the actors.
I think there's a chemistry that's lacking.
Yeah.
And from all the actors.
I wonder if that's...
Except for Billy Crudup.
Billy Crudup, yeah. Marion Cotillard probably
Marion is. Cotillard, like, you know what I mean? Like, Marion Cotillard's almost like a... She can almost... It's Marion Cotillard, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, she brings heart in everything.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with she has such a...
She's soulful.
That's really the perfect word. Thank you, Jeff. She's such a soulful character. You know what I mean? Like, I still, every time I see her cry, I always think of DiCaprio telling her not to jump. You know what I mean? And she's basically, and that breaks my, when she's crying in the elevator, you know, when she's slamming on the elevator trying to talk to DiCaprio. And all of those scenes break my freaking heart, man. And and this, I look at that and you just go, oh, but then... she isn't matched.
Yes.
She needs to be matched. You know what I mean? Like she's not matched at all by Depp. Because he doesn't show any, emotional depth to match her at all.
Yeah. It's hard though. Because like you said, he could be playing this quite sociopathic because...
He could be playing it sociopathic.
It's so interesting, Craig, because I put that down to, for me, watching Depp in this, I enjoy him because I actually see someone who is basically playing a game the entire time. He knows that he has to get people to a certain point before he is going to cut and run. And he basically, I saw him as a master manipulator.
Yeah, so very true.
So at all times he is he's cold on purpose. So he is distancing people so he doesn't get any attachment to them. Which is why when he has, I'm calling it, there's a couple thief moments in this film. There's a really clear one, which is they're all sitting on top of the rooftop looking down on when they're going to do a job and all that sort of stuff. That was like we've jumped in the DeLorean to just do the thief rooftops scoping out. But the other thief moment is the moment where they're in the restaurant and Dillinger's telling Cotillard how much he loves her, you know, the coat check moment.
Yeah, it's very, yeah.
And it's very thiefy, you know, in the sense of, I'm going to tell you, I'm a criminal. I'm going to be honest about all this stuff. And she says, why would you tell me that?
Yeah, you don't walk out on me again. that aggressive, yeah.
And so I guess probably what we get from James Caan that we don't get from Depp is the soulful eyes. You know, you can tell that James Caan is hard in Thief, but he also still has a heart in this.
But it's so weird.
The diner scene shows that, but then that's
why... This is Johnny Depp, man.
Yeah.
This is fucking Edward Scissorhand. How can you not say he doesn't have soulful eyes? You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying you just said that. I'm just saying, like, you know, and I agree with you. I 100% agree with you. Like, how can Johnny Depp be so... lifeless when it's fucking Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
this is what makes me say that this has to be a conscious decision.
Yeah, same. I agree with you. It has to be a conscious. I just didn't like that conscious decision.
Yeah. Even the moment, there's a moment where it's the poster moment. He's on the side of the car holding the Tommy gun. His hair's waving in slow motion as they pull away from the job. And you can see there's a moment where he gets a smile on his face. And it's this little moment, and in his eyes, it's not a, I love this. You know, someone else would be like, I love this job. Woo, you know, achievement unlocked, you know, that sort of moment. But it's almost this moment where he's cold and he's like, yep, we did that. What's next? You know, just like, so I think it's a conscious decision. Whether it is a good one, whether it's not, I think it's a conscious decision. And he's probably playing the character as man wanted Dillinger to be.
Yeah, of course, because it's man. Like we say, it's where everything you see on screen is what man wants it to be.
Yeah,
and so totally. And which is good and bad, but it's good in if it you can only lay the responsibility, whether it's good or bad, at man's feet.
Yeah, totally. And as we learned in our Stuart Beattie interview, he says, like, you know, the no one wants to make a bad film.
Yeah.
No one wants to act poorly, you know, like or have a character misinterpreted. And so a lot of these things are really sort of, they're things that, yeah, I don't believe that Johnny Depp was trying to portray this incorrectly.
No, I agree.
So yeah, now we can't talk this film, Craig. I'm worried that if we were to move on to what we thought about the film without acknowledging this, that I'd be really disappointed later on. But I love David Wenham. I'm just saying it. One day he's going to be on this podcast and Diver Dan, I'll hear his lovely voice. But again, like, he's so good in this.
Oh, David Wenham is just one of those actors that, it's funny that Australians do get those, you know, that you grab onto them, you know, like Noah Taylor or Ben Mendelsohn, you know.
Jason Clarke.
Yeah, Jason Clarke. Look, seriously, Jason Clarke and Johnny Depp are the best relationship in the movie.
Yeah, they're so good, aren't they?
They actually look like really good friends. And there's actually clear moments in that movie where, actually, when I think about it, is where there is some lightheartedness.
Yes.
And they both play that part, those parts well. That you actually believe that is Johnny Depp's, like, that is Dillinger's number one relationship.
Yeah, well, it's the person he loves.
Yeah.
And the way that Dillinger can love is through those brotherhood moments, not necessarily a relationship with the opposite sex. And so it's so believable because you know those two have been through everything together.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really cool. Michael Mann actually in the press said that Jason Clarke was the best actor he'd worked with in a very long time after this film.
Oh, Jason Clarke is one of the best actors. He's Oscar just waiting for him.
Oh, it is waiting for him. I think he needs to olden up a bit. Like when he looks older, he's just going to have one of those things. But like, again, he's like such a great actor. I keep going back to, he's so good in The Great Gatsby. It's like ridiculous how good he is. And we loved him in Zero Dark Thirty.
So. Yeah.
There's so much great Jason Clarke stuff. We talk about Matt Reeves again. Go watch Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Oh, not Rise. Go watch War of the Planet of the Apes. He's so darn good in that film. So I love it. Now, Craig, I've got to ask you, overall, do you have anything else before we sort of wrap up what we're chatting about the film? You got anything else you want to say?
No, not really. It's a weird thing. It's a very weird film for me. Weird in the fact that what I visually think and what I heard, but it's so contrast to what I feel about the film, what I felt during the film. It didn't actually capture me in any way, shape or form. Visually, it just looks fantastic, apart from obviously that shootout in the woods. I just left empty. I feel like a sociopath watching it.
I love it. Well, I think we're going to disagree on this film because I really enjoyed this. And like I said, I probably, any other director, I'd probably be putting this pretty high on my list when we get to ranking. And we're going to move there now. But it's really difficult to sort of, for me to put this around. Like if we didn't have films like, say, Collateral or The Insider, you know, when you start really pulling apart the work that Michael Mann's done, you go, what an incredible filmography he's got.
Oh, yeah, incredible.
Because, again, like, thinking of The Last of the Mohicans, reflecting on that film, I'm like, far out. Like, I enjoyed this film more than Last of the Mohicans, and I know that's a bit of a naughty thing to say, but let's take a quick look at the whiteboard for you, Craig.
Done.
We're moving into ranking. But Craig has at number one, Heat. Number two, The Insider. Number three, Collateral. Number four, The Last of the Mohicans. Five, Ali. Six, Manhunter. Seven, The Keep. Eight, Thief. And nine, Miami Vice. And for myself, I've got, controversially, The Insider at number one.
Controversially, I love it.
Heat at number two, Collateral at number three, Ali at number four, followed by Last of the Mohicans, Thief, Manhunter, Miami Vice, and The Keep. Now, I'm really fascinated, Craig. This is the 10th film of Michael Mann's that we've talked this season. Where are you putting Public Enemies?
Just above The Keep.
Just above The Keep. Oh, very interesting.
Fucking so, just above. I scarily think there's more chemistry in The Keep.
Oh, that is hilarious. So we're so Public Enemies is at number 7 for Craig. Very interesting. For myself, I'm putting this at number 4.
Oh, Jeff Reed. Oh, we're only like 3 away, you know what I mean?
So I really love it. Like I said, I think this film takes what he did in Ali, which I really enjoyed, and he just hones that a bit better. And I think we get that sort of snapshot time period just a bit better than Ali, and it feels like a cohesive film. Again, like, I think this is a really fascinating character study of John Dillinger. I really love Depp in it. Again, like, I can see why you think he's cold, Craig, but I love that about him. I love that he is charming. I probably would have liked just a few more moments like the press conference where we get his charm. I would have loved to have seen him, you know, seduce a few people as well in the lead up to Marion Cotillard's arrival. So we know that he's captured everybody's hearts.
Yeah.
But I think Michael Mann is still showing a 10th film in his filmography. And again, like so many directors at this stage of their filmography, we're seeing poor work.
Yeah.
But this is still solid work. So I watch it and I go, oh, man, this is definitely not like those directors say, like your Ron Howards, even to an extent Robert Zemeckis, we felt his work started dropping off in quality towards the end. Again, Zemeckis is still pulling out films like Allied late in his career, which is a great film. Another Marion Cotillard, that's right.
I think that shit's all over this film.
Oh, and let's say Brad Pitt as a John Dillinger would be fantastic casting. But I think Michael Mann's still bringing really quality filmmaking. He's making good films late in his career. And it actually makes me really excited for next week's film, Craig, because we are talking next week Black Hat with Chris Hemsworth.
Wow. This is the film I'm most excited for.
I'm so fascinated.
I haven't seen it.
Can I say, I am so in the dark in this film, Craig.
Same.
That I literally have the poster to go by. I don't think I've even seen a trailer.
Seriously, it's like my whole head is covered with a black hat. You're allowed to have
That's
a dad joke.
Terrible. But a boom. That is terrible. But, Craig, now, if people have been listening and they're like, those guys do not know a thing about Johnny Depp, I want to just argue the heck out of this.
Yep.
Where can people find us?
Well, you can go to Instagram or on to Twitter at FFTL Podcast. If you go on to Facebook as well, you can obviously do some commenting on there and some crazy gifs from First Last Podcast. We're on there. Email us at info@fftlpodcast.com or go onto our website, www.fftlpodcast.com.
Love it, Craig. Please subscribe. Like we say each week, subscribe. It helps us get there straight away to your whatever device you're listening on. Share us with a friend.
Our private jet needs fuel.
That's right.
That's right. You've got to live our rock star lifestyle, guys. You're helping it.
That's
exactly Don't make
right.
me release an OnlyFans page. Okay? You don't need to see these titties. Or do you? FFTL titties. Boom.
Hashtag.
Hashtag it. If it reaches 50,000, I'll get my titties out for you.
So good. We'll put titties. This alongside Craig's lobbying for Jeff to watch The Exorcist. I'll be lobbying for Craig to get his boobies out.
Damn right. 50,000 per titty. Not both titties. 50,000 per titty.
I can tell you, Craig has incredibly small nipples.
Incredibly small nipple. I have a beautiful Asian titties. Beautiful Asian titties. If you've ever watched just overweight Asian men movies, you know what my titties look like. All you Asians out there, you know what my titties look like. There's no hair, no nipple. Just all titty. Sweet titty. Sweet Asian titty. Sweet and sour. Sweet and sour titty.
Sweet sugar.
Just dip into them.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, take them to market. The farmer's market.
While you're sitting there pondering exactly what Craig's breasts look like, listen, boil the kettle, turn on the coffee machine, treat yourself to a little bit of Glee coffee, and you'll get an idea of a similar colour to Craig's nipples.
Yeah, yeah, if it's creamy.
Oh, look, Craig's skin's like a milky coffee. His nipples are like a dark roast.
Damn right.
You'll have to pay to see that in real life. That is for sure. So check out our friends at Glee Coffee.
Hashtag.
We love them. Use our discount code FFTL at the checkout. You're going to get a sweet discount.
Get
on
a sweet
delicious coffee.
Discount. That's good coffee, man. I'm not going to back all week this week.
It's so good, isn't it, Craig?
It is a damn good coffee, man. Damn good coffee. Seriously, so, no shit, guys. I'm not just saying this because, you know, we're flooding ourselves in coffee beans right now. It's fucking good coffee.
It is. It's really darn good. Someone said to me the other day, oh, this is, you've been loving your coffee, Jeff. Yeah, and I said, that's right. It's good coffee.
Mr. Wolf would love this coffee.
He would.
Mr. Wolf
he
out would. Of, yeah. Yeah, for those, you should know who that is.
You should definitely know.
Yeah, so it's not that cheap shit.
Next week, Craig, we are talking the last film in Michael Mann's filmography. It's Black Hat with Chris Hemsworth, and I'm so keen to get there. So I can't wait to get there. So from all of us here at From First to Last podcast, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And we'll catch you next week.
See you guys.
Loving your coffee, Jeff. Yeah, and I said, that's right. It's good coffee.
Mr. Wolf would love this coffee.
He would.
Mr. Wolf
he
out would. Of, yeah, yeah. For those, you should know who that is.
You should definitely know.
Yeah, so it's not that cheap week, shit.
Next week, Craig, we are talking the last film in Michael Mann's filmography. It's Black Hat with Chris Hemsworth. And I'm so keen to get there. So I can't wait to get there. So from all of us here at From First to Last podcast, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And we'll catch you next week.
See you guys.